Okay, so Purim is coming up, so it's kedai to spend a couple of minutes on Purim. There's a very beautiful story about the great tzaddik, whose name was Rav Shalom Rakeach. He's better known as the Sar Shalom of Bells. And the Sar Shalom of Bells would lay in the Megillah every single year, and his laying was like legendary. And when he was a young man, he wasn't yet like a known tzaddik, so he leaned Megillah in the Beis Medrash of the Chayza of Lublin. You girls heard of the Chayza of Lublin? Mm-hmm. You went to Poland, right? Yeah. So you saw the Chayza of Lublin's kever? Yes. So the people that were there, they sensed that something extraordinary was happening when he read the Megillah, but he wasn't yet a known person. And at the end of the reading of the Megillah, so the Chayza of Lublin said, "I've heard the story of Purim laned many, many times in my life, but I've never heard it quite like this." The reading of the Megillah of the Sar Shalom of Bells, it must have been something extraordinary for the Chayza of Lublin to say, "I never heard a Kriyas Megillah like the Sar Shalom of Bells." What does it mean to us? What does it mean to us to hear the Megillah in such a way that it touches us in our soul, that it transforms not just the Purim that we have, but it transforms our lives? So, to try to explore tonight a little bit about what could be special about the reading of the Sar Shalom of Bells, I want to just start with two questions. The first question is a very strange halacha. The halacha is, if you read the Megillah backwards, you're not Yotze. Now, if Chazal have to tell us that if you read the Megillah backwards, you're not Yotze, what does that imply? That we would have thought that you could read the Megillah backwards. Now, I don't know how you girls read books, but nobody starts at the end. If you start at the end of the story, you don't know what's happening. So Chazal have to come and tell us a halacha, hakoreis a Megillah mafreya lo yatsa. Of course you're not Yotze. That's not the way you read. Why would anyone even think to do that? That's our first question. The second question, which is also it's a very important question, is we know chayev inish lebesume bepurya ad lo yada bein har haman lebarach Mordechai, that a person is supposed to become fragranced with wine. How much? To the degree that at some point in Purim, they should not know the difference between Arar Haman and Baruch Mordechai. That's a very strange thing. First of all, since when in Yiddishkeit do we have a notion of getting drunk? Let alone so drunk that a person doesn't know the difference between the greatest tzaddik in the world and the biggest rasha in the world? That's the strangest thing in the world. Imagine somebody is sitting in Bnei Brak, and they don't know the difference between Yahya Sinwar Yemach Shemo, the architect of October 7th, and Rav Chaim Kanievsky, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. That's a crazy thing. To say that a person should get so drunk, and then not only that that's the level of drunk that a person should get to, but that's like the goal, that on Purim you should cry out and you should go, Yaya Sinwar, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. Chas v'shalom to say such a thing. What could it mean? Haman was a million times worse than Yaya Sinwar. Haman was ready and able to destroy all of Klal Yisrael. So what do Chazal mean? Bechlau, we don't understand this idea of drinking. And to drink to the point that I don't understand the difference between the greatest tzaddik in the world and the greatest rasha in the world, it has to mean something very, very deep. So tonight, just for a couple of minutes to try to prepare ourselves for the holy Yom Tov of Purim, which unfortunately in certain sectors today is not celebrated in the way that Chazal intended. And it's become, some people call it a Jewish Halloween, some people call it a Jewish St. Patrick's Day. Chas v'shalom, that's not at all what Chazal intended. So for us tonight, to try to understand a little bit of the Kedusha of Purim, the Kedusha of the Sar Shalom of Bells, who knew how to read the Megillah in such a way that everybody was nespal from it. So there's a yesod, there's a psychological principle in life, and it goes like this. Fundamentally, life is vulnerable. That's what life is. Everyone in this room has experienced the vulnerability of life in some way. We've all experienced some degree of pain in our lives, some degree of hurt, some degree of loneliness, of abandonment, right? Everyone in this world has experienced some degree of vulnerability. The shaila is, what do we do with that vulnerability? How do we respond to it? So most people respond to the vulnerability of life by trying to gain control over the uncontrollable. Does that make sense? I'll give you an example of what this looks like. You girls were what, in ninth grade when COVID broke out? You were entering into ninth grade, or you were finishing ninth grade? Purim of ninth grade. So do you remember how things swung from like normal to totally not normal in a very short amount of time? So I remember being at home, and I was saying to my wife, you know, we weren't davening in shul at that point. You know, there was no, shuls weren't even open. So we were making like, ki'ilu, like a minyan, not exactly a minyan. Like I was making like a Friday night matzav in my house. So like we would move the couches, and we had like an area where my daughters and my wife and myself, we would daven Kabbalah Shabbos Friday night together. And it was really beautiful and singing, and it was like a really stunning thing, but it was like you couldn't go out of the house, you know? And there was this real pachad about the vulnerability of what's going to happen. My grandmother, very shortly into COVID, passed away from COVID. She was 90 years old. She walked by somebody in the hall in her assisted living facility in New Jersey. And in those days, in the very beginning of COVID, that was a death sentence. And a short while later, she passed away. And I remember I said to my wife, I miss the illusion of control. Because that's what everyone is living with right now. Every one of us is living with this control that's really, if we unpack it, really just an illusion. And think about the amount of things that we do in our life to pretend that we have control over life's vulnerabilities. In other words, that's anxiety, let's say, on steroids is this concept, right? It's, I need to control the uncontrollable, right? So let's say, for example, somebody you know is sick, you know, and the doctors do a blood test. And there's a part of you that's like thinking like, maybe it's going to come back and chas v'shalom it'll be cancer, right? And then it comes back and it's like, no, it's just bacterial pneumonia. And you're like, Baruch Hashem, you know, it's only bacterial pneumonia, yeah? But in those moments where you had to confront the possibility that somebody you love had a blood test and maybe it was cancer, what do? You sit there and you're like, there's nothing I'm going to be able to do about this. So maybe you start Googling it, right? And you start like looking up like symptoms of cancer. You ever go like, you ever do that WebMD thing where you're like, right? Really? Okay, good. I have at least one person that's like me, yeah? Even though, don't worry, everybody's really like us, but you're the only one with the courage to say it. What was that? Yeah, everyone's done it, right? But that's what we do. Like when things get scary, we seek control. And here's the key. We seek control through the power of knowing. If I only know, then I'll have control. So we never really think about this because we, you know, knowledge is a beautiful thing to have. But knowledge could become something very toxic. And they even say it. They go, knowledge is power. And it is power to a certain degree, right? If you know what to do in life, right, you have some quote-unquote control over life, even though you really don't, right? But knowledge could become a vehicle, a tool, for trying to control the uncontrollable. And we don't think of knowledge that way. Right? Imagine you came to a shir, and the Rebbe who's giving the shir tells you, you're here for knowledge? You're here to learn about Torah? You're just a bunch of anxious people that are trying to control the uncontrollable. It's not a really good sales pitch for coming to a shir. Especially on Matzei Tanis Esther, when you girls are just getting done fasting for the day, right? Knowledge at a certain level could be corrupted. It's just a way of me trying to maintain control. That's why you have all these, like, you know, girls in seminary and guys in yeshiva, they're like, Rabbi, could you give us a class on shalom bias? Why do you want a class on shalom bias? I feel like I need to know what to do. What are you so concerned about? I'm going to get married. I'm going to have no idea what to do, right? It's like, calm me down by giving me the power of knowledge. Now, there's nothing wrong with having a shalom bias here. But you have to know when you cross the line, right? Were you learning about shalom bias because you wanted to be a better wife, a better husband? Or were you learning about shalom bias because that was your way of gaining this illusory power to have control over the anxious possibility that maybe something's going to go wrong in my marriage and I'm not going to know what to do. Right? Rabbi, can we have a parenting class? Why? Why do you want a parenting class? What happens if my teenager does exactly what I did? I don't know what to do. Why don't you know what to do? Because look what my parents did to me. Right? So, there's nothing wrong with learning, but at some point, learning gives us a feeling of power that's really a power that doesn't belong to us. It's just a way of avoiding life's vulnerabilities. Does that make sense? I'll give you an example of this. Imagine the entire world was ruled by one ruler. And he makes a party. And the biggest tzaddik in the world gets up and says, "Don't go to the party. This is a bad party. It's celebrating the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash and the fact that the Beis HaMikdash is not being rebuilt." What would you say from your power of knowing? What would you have said if a great tzaddik got up and said, "Don't go to the White House for this party"? You would have said, "If every single other nation in the world shows up to this party, and the Jews are the only ones that don't show up to the party, what's going to happen? There's going to be crazy anti-Semitism, right?" So this is exactly what happened. Achashverosh said, "Everyone's invited to the party." Every Jew said, "We have to go." What did Mordechai say? "If you go, you're messing with Hashem, because this party is celebrating the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. It's much better for Achashverosh to be upset than for Hashem to be frustrated with us." But from our power of knowing, right, from our logic, from our need to control, what did we do? We went to the party. Looking back on it, who was right? If you ever read the story of the Megillah now, you ever go like, "Yeah, but it kind of makes sense"? Like, we're not even fully bought in. Even now, we're not fully bought into Mordechai's version. Because right now, when I just told it to you, how many of us would have the courage to go, "I don't want to upset Achashverosh"? I imagine every one of us would have had a real taiva to go. By the way, it's happening in the world right now. We don't want to upset world opinion, so we're not really going into Rafah, where we know the hostages are being held, because we don't want the world to be against us. Is that crazy? But we still have the same craziness. There's a logic that we're living with, and we've bought into this knowing, which is not a good type of knowing. You understand the difference? So the story of the Megillah is about knowing when your knowledge is a function of anxiety and power and control versus when a person has to say, "I have to go beyond knowing." Because ideas are what we do. Even though ideas are not necessarily true, we turn our ideas into absolute truth because they make us feel safe. I'll give you an example of this, okay? This one might hurt a little bit. You ready? Let's say you have a roommate, and the roommate is doing something that makes you feel unsafe. So what do? You craft a narrative around that roommate. Let's say, for example, she wants the temperature at one temperature and you want the temperature at a different temperature. I'm given to understand that in seminaries, this is a very big deal. And from the fact that most of you just looked at each other, I'm going to assume that that's correct. Okay?
Next example.
Next example. It's a little too close to home? Okay. So let's say one roommate likes it a little bit colder, one roommate likes it a little bit hotter. Let's just make that up, yeah? So rather than lean into the vulnerability and say, "We have a conflict," we turn the roommate into a villain. We get an idea, not you, yeah? We get an idea and we say, "She's insensitive," right? And then we start to marshal evidence around her insensitivity. And we go around telling people, "You know, she's like so insensitive. All I did was ask for the like temperature to be a little bit hotter or a little bit colder, and she like went off on me. You should know I'm not the only one that feels this way. I spoke to a bunch of girls, and they've also experienced it that way. And 5 or 6 times this year, I could tell you examples of how insensitive she is." By the way, it's fun sitting in this moment right here, watching all of you do this. It's fun for me. It's fun. Thank you so much for coming on this journey with me. Yeah? Yeah. It's a safe space here in Sharfman's, yeah? It's a very safe space. So, What are we doing when we do that? What we're doing is we're saying something here is unsafe, so I need to have an idea, a truth, a narrative that I build and corroborate and put together to make me feel like, see, it's not my fault, it's her fault. Is that idea absolutely true that your roommate's insensitive?
No.
You know how you know that it's not absolutely true? Because she has the same exact narrative about you. Nobody's the villain in their own story. Right? Everybody in their own story has a justification for the way they're behaving. Because all you did is you took an idea, and it was just an idea. But you blew the idea up to the degree that now you could say, see, that's the idea. It's a crazy thing that we do. So what's the alternative? What's the alternative in this roommate situation? What's the alternative in life?
Be annoyed.
You know what? To a certain degree, the answer is yes. And I'll explain to you why. Okay, that's you're talking, addressing it is a beautiful idea, but before even addressing it, there's something that has to happen. I have to acknowledge and accept reality as it is, which means that I'm powerless. That's no small thing. You're in a dilemma with your roommate. This, we'll give it to you. I'm giving you tips right here. You ready?
No, you worked it out.
Okay.
You're hot. If I was cold, if it was the other way around, I'd want it.
I understand. Very beautiful.
But we're not lizards.
Right. I feel badly that I touched on such a sensitive subject right before Purim, which is Zman of Unity. The first step whenever we confront the vulnerability of life is to accept that we are powerless in this situation. I cannot control people, places, or things. And the thing that I'm scared of, if it happens, it happens. And whatever it is, then we'll deal with it. You know, many years ago, I'm not going to get into the story right now, but I learned this lesson the hard way. Many, many years ago, 9 years ago, I was in the hospital. I was in the hospital for a month, and I legitimately almost died. And I was in the ICU for a significant amount of time. I'm not going to get into the story now. It's a crazy story, but it doesn't matter. And at some point, I wasn't getting better, and the medicine wasn't working. And it was in the ICU, and all the doctors were gathered around me because it's a teaching hospital. I was in Hadassah Ein Kerem. And I wasn't really paying attention to what the doctors were talking about until I heard the doctor say the word cancer. And then I started paying attention. I said, what'd you just say? So he said, well, come back and tell you later. I said, no, you don't get to say cancer and then leave. But then they left, and I was in the ICU. I was very sick. I couldn't, like, chase them. But I got out of bed, and I started following them. Now, for me at that time to walk down the hall of Hadassah Ein Kerem Hospital took me 45 minutes. That's how sick I was. So till I caught up to them doing their rounds, it was like a couple minutes later, even though they had only gone, like, 20 feet. And they said, like, you have to go back to bed right now. I said, you don't get to say cancer and then leave. Finally, they came back to me at the end of their rounds. And they said, look, we have to consider the possibility that it's cancer. And like anyone who's, you know, in his early 30s at the time, I freaked out. I was like, what in the world? Like, what's going to happen to me? Cancer? That's crazy. Little kids. My wife was 9 months pregnant. I was like, this is crazy. So I said, well, what do we do if it's cancer? So I'll never forget, the doctor looked at me like I was a doofus. He goes, well, treat it. I said, but what if the treatment doesn't work? He goes, then we'll have a different treatment. I said, what if that doesn't work? So he started to get annoyed. He's like, well, treat it. Meaning, you do whatever you can, right? But like, I had already resigned myself to having to know all the different possibilities. I didn't want to accept the fact that the doctor was saying that maybe I have cancer, and maybe I'm going to be sick, and maybe I'm going to die. So I needed to know, like, what are you going to do that's absolutely going to save my life? But you know what a doctor knows? All we can do is accept reality as it is and treat it. That's the level of power that we have. Now, Baruch Hashem, it wasn't cancer. But there was a two-week period where we really weren't sure. That was a scary time. And yeah, I was definitely on WebMD at that time trying to find out, like, what does that mean? Because there's a level of acceptance of the vulnerability of life that none of us want to have. None of us want to look the scary parts of life in the face and go, it's possible. Every seminary girl has in her head, my marriage is going to be better. Right? But you know what? The truth of the matter is, your marriage is going to be beautiful, God willing, but it will certainly be imperfect, like every other marriage that ever was in the history of the world. But what if my kids aren't? Yes, none of your kids will be absolutely perfect. They will all make mistakes. So you could take parenting classes and make yourself mishugana, but all you're really trying to do is create some sort of power over something that is not necessarily in your circle of influence. Now, there's a level where it is in your circle of influence, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with taking parenting classes. But before you take those parenting classes, the first thing that we all have to do is accept life as it is and acknowledge that there are things in life that we are powerless over. That's what it means, ad delo yada bein arer haman lebarach Mordechai. You know, the Vilna Gaon points out, many point out, the gematria of Arar Haman and Baruch Mordechai are exactly the same gematria. You know that? They're both 502. What does this mean? What does it mean that there's no difference, or to know that you could say Arar Haman and Baruch Mordechai, you could say Arar Mordechai and Baruch Haman, and it's exactly the same thing? What does that mean? It means, and this is a hard concept, it means that that which appears to be bad and that which appears to be good, they just are steps in a part of a process, and we don't know anything more than that. What appears to us in our life to be Baruch Mordechai might be Arar. And what appear to us in our life that it might be Arar Haman could really be Baruch Haman. The worst things in life could be the best things. The best things in life might end up being the worst things. And if you just stay out of your narrative, and you just stay out of building up these ideas, you allow things to be what they are, you might discover that life is exactly the opposite of what you think it is. I'll give an example of this. Do you know that one of the greatest educators in the history of the world was a man whose name was Shmuel Bar Shilas? Gemara in Sanhedrin, 96b, the Gemara in Baba Basra, 8b, says that he was a convert. He came from the family of Haman, and he was so devoted to teaching Torah that he didn't have to pay taxes. You know why he didn't have to pay taxes? Because he literally lived in yeshiva, and he didn't leave. All he did was teach Torah all day long. What's the pshat? What's the pshat in this, that Haman could have such a descendant? Because we look at Haman and say, it's the worst thing in the world. And of course, in its moment, it is. But do we really know what Haman is? Do we really know what that process of Haman is going to look like? Who knows? Maybe a Shmuel Bar Shilas is going to come out of Haman. Do you know that the Gemara says the descendants of Haman taught Torah in Bnei Brak? And according to some, that means Rav Akiva. Rav Akiva, who was greater even than Moshe Rabbeinu when it came to understanding Torah, the Gemara says. That Rav Akiva and Moshe Rabbeinu said you should give the Torah through him because he even has a higher level of understanding than I do. Was a descendant of Haman.
Wait, I thought they killed.
Okay, so that's a good question, what it means. But Haman had descendants. It's a good question. And he killed his 10 sons, but the question is how to get those...
All around.
Very good, very good. It's a big conversation. I'm not going to get into it right now, but excellent, great point. But the idea is that we're so convinced that Haman is evil, and of course what he did was evil, but do we know the final story of how things play out? I'll give you an example of this. Let's say you have a boy... And he's a Lebedik kid in high school. You know what they do with Lebedik children? They throw them out of school. Yeah? So here you have a boy, and he gets thrown out of yeshiva. Yeah? And now what does he do? He's on the streets. He's got to figure out what to do with his life. So he goes and he finds a job. And he starts like learning from somebody. I'm making the story up as I go along. Let's say he finds a job working with somebody who's flipping houses. So this guy who's flipping houses, you know what he does? He buys houses, and he fixes up the houses, and then he's able to sell them for $100,000, $150,000 more. So this kid starts apprenticing by him. And you know what happens? This kid, he starts getting really good at it, and he gets some money together. And you know what he does? He starts flipping houses himself. And all of a sudden, the kid has got some self-esteem because he's got some money in his pocket, and he says, oh, look at me, I'm competent. I could do something with my life. And now, before long, as a 16, 17-year-old kid, he's already flipped 5 or 6 houses, and the kid has $200,000-$300,000 in the bank. It's unbelievable. But now he's not the same 14-year-old kid that he was when he got thrown out of yeshiva. He has some skills. He has some confidence. You know what happens? He decides to himself, I want to learn Torah. Now he's a person who learned some discipline. So he decides, I'm going to go to Eretz Yisrael. And he enrolls in a yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. And he comes to yeshiva, and it turns out that even though he went to a lower level yeshiva because he didn't necessarily have the skills that he could have gotten in high school, it turns out that he's head and shoulders above every other kid in the yeshiva. You know why? Because he's a guy that knows how to wake up in the morning, put in a hard day's work, and get things done. In a short amount of time, he's already out of that yeshiva. He becomes one of the top bacharim in that yeshiva. Why? Because he's got skills. He knows how to put in a good work ethic. He moves up from yeshiva to yeshiva to yeshiva, and all of a sudden, this guy is in a real serious yeshiva, and he's considered a real plugger. And you know what he does? He goes, the best thing that ever happened to me was I got thrown out of yeshiva. Even though I missed those years of learning, I see that what I thought then was Arar Haman was really Baruch Haman. That Rebbe that chucked me from yeshiva, I hated his guts, but I see that Hashem had a better plan. I just didn't know it at the time. Imagine if we would live life that way. We would go, ad delo yada. I'm getting to a level where whatever happens, I'm going to accept it as it is, but I'm not going to make up stories about it. I'm not going to say that's the worst thing that ever happened to me or that's the best thing that ever happened to me because I have no idea what it is that just happened. I only know that this is what it is and this is what I feel. So something that appeared to be tragic might not be tragic at all. And something that appeared to be amazing might not be amazing at all. I'm just accepting reality as it is, and I'm not building any stories around it. Imagine what our lives could look like. Imagine how much happier we would be that way. This is what the Lubavitcher Rebbe says, Arar Haman and Baruch Mordechai means. It's hard to know what's good and what's not good. What's a tool of Hashem to move us in this direction, or a tool of Hashem to move us in that direction? It's not obvious. It's never obvious. Let's go back. What does it mean? Akore es haMegillah leMafreya lo yotza. If you read the Megillah starting with the 10th chapter and go to the first chapter, you're not yotze. Why would anyone do that? Now, do you girls understand? Because if you read it from the end, then what do you know? It's like, now I have power. I know how the story is going to end, right? So it makes us feel really good to read the story backwards. Imagine you opened up a book, right? So nobody would ever do this. We open up a book. Imagine you bought a Goyisha book, yeah? You opened up the book. It's a story. You opened up the book and you read the last chapter. I just can't handle the anxiety of wondering what's going to happen the entire time. That's so sad. It's so, if you read a book, if you read a book, you know what you want to experience? You want to experience the vulnerability of the journey that I don't know how this book is going to end. That's what we all did with Harry Potter, right? For you girls, by the time you girls were old enough to read Harry Potter, probably all seven were out, so you could have binge read them. But you know, when I was growing up, I was already married, and Harry Potter started coming out, you had to wait from one Harry Potter to the next. And people, you should know, once they got their Harry Potters, they would read them like in a night. They would read them in a night. Was that? Yeah, I have to binge watch all the Netflix shows at once. I have to be able to see all of this show at once. Because why? Because I can't handle the vulnerability of waiting week to week. You should know, when I was a kid growing up, there was something called must-see TV NBC Thursdays. I'm not telling you what shows were on, but some of those shows are on Netflix today. Yeah, and it used to be that you had to wait from week to week to see will they or won't they get back together. Who knows what it'll be with Rachel and Ross. I'm not telling you which shows. I'm just saying that's the way you grew up. You needed to know, like, what's going to be? You had to learn to embrace the vulnerability. If somebody opens up the Megillah, which is the story of our lives, it's the story of Klal Yisrael's history, and they go, I know the end. Okay, now I'm okay, because I know the end. Then you missed the whole point of Purim. The whole point of Purim is to embrace the vulnerability of your life story and to say, I don't know how this is going to end up, but it's okay. And girls, that's the time that we're living in right now. The time that we're living in right now is completely uncertain. I'm going to say something. I don't know if any of you girls have thought it. I imagine some of you have, but I'm going to say it out loud. I'm betting some of you are wondering, what happens if over Pesach, the state of Israel goes to war with Lebanon? I'm betting some of you are wondering that. What will it mean for the rest of my seminary year? Is it going to be like COVID, that they won't let us back? Is there going to be SEM? Will there not be SEM, right? And we could spend our time. It's okay, I've been there. Yeah? It's okay, I appreciate it. We could spend our time sitting and wondering and reading the news all the time and going, what's going to be, what's going to be, what's going to be? Or we could say, whatever it's going to be, it will be. I don't have to make up any stories around it. Think about how amazing our lives would be if we could let go of the anxiety of control. That's the avoda. This Purim, it seems impossible, right? But that's the avoda of Purim. The avoda of Purim is to move beyond a level of knowing. That whatever I think I know, I don't even know that. That only at the very end of this story, in the times of Mashiach, is Hashem going to go and go, that, you thought that was good? That was the worst thing. And that thing that appeared to be terrible, it was the most incredible thing. I don't like to say this because I don't like to like ever give a narrative around history, but it's certainly true that every single time Klal Yisrael has gone through terrible persecution, almost immediately afterwards, we've experienced unbelievable flourishing. It's certainly true, again, I don't like to put these two things together, but historically speaking, it is a fact that after 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust, only a short couple of years later, we were given the gift of coming back to Eretz Yisrael. And it's certainly true that in the last 80 years, we've had an unbelievable flourishing of Yiddishkeit here. It's hard to know what's good and what's bad. All we can do is let go and let God, as they say in Alcoholics Anonymous. Remember, I'm not saying what's positive or negative. I'm saying all we have is the not knowing. That appears, that which appears to be terrible might be the best gift in the world. Again, when we speak about getting drunk on Purim, hopefully we're not speaking about the drunkenness of acting like a lunatic. Hopefully we're speaking about the drunkenness of moving beyond what we know to be true to a level of truth that is beyond our comprehension. That's the idea. I know that it's not necessarily the way that Purim is celebrated today, but that's what Chazal meant. That's why some say that you can even be Yotzei by going to sleep. Because we say in the times of Mashiach, we're going to look back and say, Hayinu kechomim. We were like dreamers. We were like dreamers. We were dreaming. We don't know what's what today. Everything doesn't make, nothing makes sense in this world. So we want to get to that level of sleep that sometimes comes with a little bit of wine. That's why, you know, in the times of Purim, even those Jews that were totally assimilated, not one of them stood with Haman. Not one of them converted. You know, that was, Haman said, if you convert, you're out of the decree. Not one Jew, even those Jews that were totally off the derech, not one Jew converted. Why? Because when you go past the level of knowing and you go to the essence, a Jew is a Jew is a Jew is a Jew. When we go past the level of knowing, that's when we have unity. Do you realize that all of our knowledge created disunity in Klal Yisrael? All of the different things that we know, oh, you're this type of Jew, you're this type of Jew, you're Sephardi, you're Ashkenazi, you're Satmar, you're Lubavitch, you're Yeshivas, you're Hasidus, you're Modern Orthodox, right? We figured out all this knowledge, we figured out how to use it to create separation. But if we move beyond the realm of knowing and we move to the essence of all things, just accepting everything as it is, then what are we? We're all just Jews. This is the state of Achdus that needs to exist. Our anxiety created this disunity. And it's our responsibility to recreate it. Girls, have a Freilichen and a meaningful Purim.